Okay, so I'm just thinking I'm going to talk about the revised Quasar sequence. So Paolo just gave a nice overview of the Quasar sequence. This is from the Vittati papers. So this is the, on the left here, the anti-correlation between the peak Sigurd-Schrammi Minazzi and the peak Sigurd-Schrammi frequency. This is the anti-correlation that he originally found, or they originally found. And on the right, we have the 5 gigahertz luminosity versus Sigurd-Schrammi luminosity. So just showing the original Quasar sequence here. Okay, and so since that time, there have been a lot of there's been a lot of work on the Quasar sequence. This is just one example by Paolo Giomi from earlier this year. So this isn't exactly the same thing because on the y-axis here, on the y-axis here, you have the sum of the Sigurd-Schrammi-Compton peak luminosities here. So it's not exactly the same thing, but it's very similar. And you'll see, you get this this L shape here. So this sort of L shape has been seen by a lot of people. It's been seen by people in 2006, and then by Eileen Meyer, who's going to talk about that right after me. So yeah, there seems to be an L shape here, and as Paolo just said, this part of the sequence up here could be explained by the objects with unknown redshift. So that's another thing to keep in mind. Okay, so the original explanation for the Quasar sequence was by Gabriel Guicciani. So the idea here is that the external radiation field is tied to the power that you have injected into the electron. And so as that power increases, the Sigurd-Schrammi peak luminosity increases, and the external radiation field increases also. So that lowers your cooling Lorentz factor here. And so the cooling Lorentz factor moves to lower energies. So the peak Sigurd-Schrammi frequency is associated with that, so that also moves to lower frequency. Okay, and so the typical way that people calculate the Sigurd-Schrammi peak is by fitting it with third-degree polynomial. So this is what was done by Vassati originally, and it's been done by numerous people since then. So Paolo Giomi and the Latin collaboration, they provided bits to the blazars in the lat right AGN sample. They provided formulae for determining the peak using the radio optical and X-ray data. So using this alpha RO, alpha OX, so the slope between the radio and optical, and slope between the optical and X-ray. And they provided empirical formulae for finding these peaks just based on optical data. So if you have alpha RO and alpha OX or a blazar, you can find its peak. So these are the formulae when the second Latin AGN catalog came out. This is how they determined the new peak. From this, they classified it as an HSP, LSP, or an ISP. So we can also determine the peak flux from formulae that Paolo Giomi found. So just using this equation based on the 5 gigahertz radio flux density at the peak frequency, you can find the peak flux. So we can do that to create a blazar sequence from the lat AGN catalog. So the first one that I did, this is a size original diagram. This is the sequence created from the 2-lac. So the black here are FSRQs, the red are BLACs, and the green ones, the green squares are AGN of unknown type, so it's not clear if they're a BLAC or an FSRQ. There's clearly an anti-correlation here. There's no L shape, right? There's no L or V shape or anything like that. So what's the explanation for this? So Matt talked about this yesterday, but one possibility is that just the SED as it moves to higher frequency, this luminosity is going to go down just because the whole SED is shifting in this way. But just to point out, so this would sort of not favor this cooling interpretation, right? So the problem is when you calculate this peak, you're calculating it using the 5 gigahertz luminosity, right? Or 5 gigahertz plus. So, somebody asked yesterday, when you fit SEDs, you never fit the radio data, basically, because that's considered from a different region of the jet. So if you really wanted to find the peak, you, and it, and you're, so there's, I guess, And what I'm saying is there's a disparity between the interpretation and how you determine the peak. If the peak is from the cooling grid, then you don't want to use the 5 GHz data to find the peak, right? Because that should be from a different region of the jet.
So anyway, that's sort of the point I'm making here.
Okay, so we can also measure the peak synchrotron luminosity and then the peak frequency and create a diagram based on that. Again, this is sort of the original diagram from the 1998 paper. So these sources are these are all the sources in the 2 lakh clean sample with known redshifts and enough measurements for a well-defined synchrotron peak. So that turns out to be about 350 sources. And there does seem to be a V shape here, or an L shape, I guess, depending on how you want to look at it. But I think it looks more like a V shape to me.
So anyway, we want to see if there are any correlations here.
So we look at the VLX only first. So we use the Spearman Kendall rank coefficients to see if there's a correlation. So for the VLX, there seems to be a low probability. So this is obviously there's no correlation. There's no correlation, or a high probability that there is a correlation. And the same for the FSRQs only. And then when we combine the samples, there seems to be an extremely low probability that there's no correlation.
So it seems that there is a correlation. But again, there is the possibility that the objects with unknown redshift could, destroy this correlation if those are taken into account.
Okay, so next we looked at the high energy component. And so, Paolo and his collaborators, they also have a way of determining the peak, of the constant component just based on the lat spectral index. So their fit, is shown here. That's the black line. And then the red points are the objects in the LBAS sample. So it seems to be a reasonable way of estimating the peak frequency.
So
once we know the peak frequency and we know what the power law is and the luminosity from lats, right? We know the lat spectral index and the lat flux, so we can just extrapolate that back to find the peak luminosity of the constant component. And so that's what we did. So this is again for the LBAS sample. So these are the the peak constant luminosities that Paolo got from his fit, the LBAS waveforms. Then on this axis, the estimated constant peaks that we got from using the technique. So there does seem to be a pretty reasonable agreement in this line is where those two are equal, of course. So we can do better than that also by using the SWIFT-BAT catalog. So about 10% of our sources are also the SWIFT-BAT catalog. So we can use that to also constrain the peak, the constant peak.
So we did that, and
so we created this plot here. So this is constant dominance versus the peak of the synchrotron component. So constant dominance is the ratio of the luminosity of the constant peak to the ratio of the luminosity of the constant peak to the luminosity of the synchrotron peak. So we definitely see a very well-defined L shape here. And there does seem to be there does seem to be an anti-correlation. It's quite clear. And so the interesting thing about this is that the constant dominance does not depend on redshift. So we can also plot the objects that don't have a redshift here. So that's what we've done. These are the rightward pointing triangles here. So the peak synchrotron frequency does depend on redshift, but it doesn't depend on it very strongly. It's only a factor of 1 plus z, so it's a factor of z. So all of these points are actually lower limits. They can be higher by a factor of 1 plus z, but that's not going to change it very much. So, okay, so we have this plot, and we want to look at the correlations here. So so we just look at the VLX, first of all, and there seems to be a correlation. We look at the FSRQs only, and so there's about a 90% chance that there's no correlation. So
the FSRQs, you can even see it here, the black point, there doesn't seem to be a correlation.
Okay, so we look at all the sources with known redshift, and there's essentially a zero chance that there's no correlation. So there's definitely a correlation here. And then we can also put in all the sources with unknown redshift and assume they're at a redshift of zero. So we put that in, and there's essentially a 100% chance that a correlation is there. And then we assume, just to make sure there's not some problem with our assumption of the redshift of these sources, we can assume they're at a redshift of 0.35. So that's the average redshift for VLX 2 lakh. So we do that, and there's a 100% chance of correlation. And then we just put them at the highest redshift that we didn't think, although it seems reasonable. So the highest redshift of an object in the 2-lag is 3.1. So we put them at a redshift even higher than that. And again, there's essentially a 100% chance that there's a correlation. So the point of this is that here's a correlation where objects with unknown redshifts, it doesn't destroy them, essentially. So we have a fairly good confirmation of the Blazar sequence from this. Okay, so we want to talk about the physical interpretation of this. So I mentioned that earlier. As the external radiation field increases, that goes to lower energies, and thus the synchrotron peak frequency also moves to lower frequencies. Okay, so this is for if you eject a power wall. So you have a power wall ejection between gamma 1 and gamma 2, right? And so it creates this break that looks sort of like this. Your electron distribution has a break here. It breaks by 1. But if this cools so much that gamma C becomes below gamma 1, then you'll get an electron distribution that looks more like this. So the break will be associated with gamma 1 rather than gamma C. And so below the break, you have gamma goes minus 2. Above the break, it goes as minus Q minus 1. And then this, so what we're saying then is that your peak frequency will be associated with gamma 1 rather than gamma C. And gamma 1 will essentially be independent of power. Okay, so we just created a sort of a toy model based on this. So we're scaling the electrons, the electron injection, just by some dimensionless parameter L, so sort of the dimensionless power. And then we scale the Lorentz factor with this L also. So BLBI tends to show that higher power objects tend to have higher Lorentz factors, so we just scale it at some power law. And then spectral modeling tends to show that higher power objects have higher magnetic fields, so we also scale magnetic field power. And of course, we also scale the external energy density with power as well. So we have sort of a two-parameter engine for Blazars. So it's just the two parameters are just power and the viewing angle to the line of sight. So we're going to use that to try to reproduce the Blazar sequence. And so that's what we have here. So this is the peak frequency versus peak luminosity. And so each of these curves is for a different viewing angle. So the blue one is at 0 degrees. The purple one is at 1 degree. The orange one is at 2 degrees in the line of sight. So this is the lower power objects here. So they move along the sequence, the higher power. And then up to here, really the highest power. So in this branch of the curve, you have gamma cool greater than gamma 1. So this depends very strongly, the new peak depends very strongly on the power. But then when you get to here, the new peak starts to be associated with gamma 1. Because gamma C goes below gamma 1. So this becomes, the power is essentially independent of the peak frequency, more or less. So this starts to go essentially vertical. But the reason it doesn't go completely vertical is because the new peak also depends on the magnetic field and the Lorentz factor. So this starts to increase. This will start to increase because the magnetic field and the Lorentz factor, especially the magnetic field, can increase. So that creates sort of an L shape. Okay. So as you move to higher angles, then you move in this direction on the sequence, and it seems to explain essentially all of the BLX. Okay, so there's this inflection you'll notice here, right, in this curve here. So this is caused by what is dominating the total radiation field. So in this branch, the magnetic field energy density is dominating the total energy density, and in this region over here, the external radiation field is dominating the total energy density. So that creates this sort of inflection in this sequencing here. Now the this model does not explain all of the FN circuits very well. As you move to higher angles, this goes down, as Marcus said earlier, this goes down delta to the fourth, but it moves to the left as just delta. So it doesn't explain all of the FN circuits. So one possibility we thought of is just maybe gamma 1 changes independently of the power, and then that would move this to the left or to the right, explaining all of the FSRQs. Or maybe just the way we determine the peak frequency isn't very good. Okay, so we can also make a plot on the constant dominance diagram. So over here, so again, we have the low power objects over here, the ones up to higher power objects. And then, okay, and again, over in this region, we have gamma cool, but gamma 1, so the peak frequency is again, and we associate it with gamma 1 over here, and then over here is associated with gamma cool. And then, another interesting
interesting feature here. So here the county dominance is the county is dominated by SSC. So there's this doesn't really move as we move to higher angles, the SSC component. And so that's because the SSC has the same beaming pattern as Supertrog, so this ratio is essentially going to be the same no matter what your angle is. Whereas over here you have the external component, and this does depend on external component has a different beaming pattern than synchrotron, so you do get a movement along this diagram over in this region. Okay, so just the summary. So we generated laser sequence for the TRAC, and we created the largest sample yet for the compound dominance plot. So the EGRET era, this similar plot had around 30 sources. So the blazars with unknown redshift could ruin the L-peak, U-peak anti-correlation, which Pablo said earlier, but it doesn't seem to be able to ruin this compound dominance versus U-peak anti-correlation. The standard cooling scenario, if we include gamma 1 and we associate U-peak with gamma 1, it does seem to be able to explain this V and L shape on the L-peak, U-peak, and compound dominance and U-peak diagram. So that's it. Thank you. Right, so we, in the plot I showed here, I think I used 200, but I don't think that the parameters, the exact parameter choices we made are really unique. I mean, I think we could reproduce these plots with other choices of parameters as well. But yeah, for those, it's 200. No. I mean, there might be, but I don't know what it is. But I don't think if we use a different gamma 1 and then we use a different, say, a different normalization for our magnetic field and Lorentz factor, we could get a similar plot. So I don't think that's really unique, right?
Yeah,
that's
fine.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
So are you thinking that the line you're going to have to think about this that's not
Right, so as you go to larger and larger angles, I think at some point this is going to break down. So yeah, I think your diagram is going to be correct. I think it has to be correct at some level. I mean, because of what we see with radio galaxies. I mean, we know that they seem to have lower Lorentz, from STD fitting, we know they have to have lower Lorentz factors. So I think at some level they do have to be stratified, so that does have to be correct at some point, I would say.
Quick question.
Wait, so which luminosity are you talking about?
Well, I'm not sure that I agree that for the dust or the energy program. I mean, I think there are super dominated Donata supposed to be F1 yet.
Next up, we have